Yeah, so we were, a small team. Fellow named Peter Farson, Karen Galikas, and I, we had to do all the missile shots. And so I modeled the Maverick missile. Had to figure out like, okay, what are they launching? And because Cameron was very, he was very specific on all the technicals having to be right. So even though, modeling was what was how I got into to Metrolight Studios, it's one of those things I really appreciate when it's done really well, but I so don't enjoy it. And it's sort of like when I took my first real life drawing class, Glenn Vilppu, who was my teacher, he looks over my shoulder and he's like, if this was an evening class, I'd tell you to drink a little wine, before. Because I had to learn, not to draw with my wrist, but with my elbow and, loosen up. And modeling, I don't know how to model with my elbow. So I just, it's so tedious to me and time consuming the way I fixate. And so I just don't enjoy it. But nobody else was volunteering to make the Maverick. So I modeled the Maverick, and thanks to Jimbo, I was teaching myself RenderMan. So I started working on shaders for the missile, and then Peter Farson was working on shaders for, how we were this like
And you had to write the shaders
really
at the time.
right. Yeah, and back, back then, everything nowadays, there's nodes that represent all the math operations and, nodes that let you pull in all of your attributes and just, wire them up and do things very visually. It was VI or Emacs or, whatever your, back then, what your text editor was, that, was just as much of a religious statement as whether you preferred camel case or underbars. And so it was all just, text code defining in RenderMan SL, the shading language, how things were supposed to look. But based on everything else, it was just like, okay, this is just how things work. So I'm gonna learn what I need to be able to do this. And then, one of those things that we also had to do was composite, and we didn't really want to wait. We could have queued up and waited for one of the dedicated compositors to work with it. But Karen's background, she came from, doing tons of video post, and where she would be a, one man army on it. And so, she was one of like Jimbo and Mark before then was, on this project was the biggest influence. And like, okay, yeah, we're gonna do everything that we can, and so we're gonna take on the compositing for these. And we were really excited about, okay, this new package Nuke that
Because that's
Phil's,
what Nuke, the
working
name
on.
is, right? New compositor. That's the joke name. It's not new anymore, but.
Yeah, I mean, and then it, it kind of, there are, the I think before and afters, things were, folks had their ideas about what it meant and what it meant to them. And so I fully believe, and new compositor is the way I thought of it with the subtext. I think there was always the subtext of, the nuke. You're not gonna flame or inferno. You're gonna nuke it. There were folks that thought of it that way. This is gonna be bigger than an inferno. This is a nuke. And then others, it was, you're nuking these ingredients in a microwave. And so it, I think everybody sort of had, they subscribed to whatever headcanon made them, enjoy it more. And there were internal discussions about, from the beginning about, this becoming a product that, if it's developed, because there were so few options on the market and they were so expensive and they were so limited, they from the beginning recognized the potential, even 1993, recognized the potential to sell Nuke. because from the beginning it was Price Pethel made no bones about, you know, it had to be the highest quality processing of anything on the market. I mean, that was a mandate because the beginning. So.
It was linear from the beginning, right, from the get-go.
Well, it was float from the beginning. We didn't have the whole like linear light workflow. That was a process that developed later on. And I think at DD, Mike Camphor was the spearhead for that. But early on, the first version of Nuke, it was even if it wasn't linear light, it was float. You know, we didn't. There was, I believe, possibly an argument at one point over, you know, like, well, if we sell this, you know, externally, you know, we sell it to customers that have PCs or Macs or, you know, whatever, they're going to be dealing with 8-bit imagery or at most 16-bit imagery. So should we, you know, follow convention? Because everything else, you know, on the market worked. You know, you basically had a toggle if it functioned out above 8 bits per channel at all. No, the mandate was always, you know, we're a floating point, and a lot of work was done early on concatenating transforms. Like the pixel was sacred with the during the development of Nuke, and I think all along, going into UI, going into 3D, the biggest mandate, and one of the kind of the cultural sort of pressures at DD was to consider the original pixels, you know, the plate of the client, you know, those pixels are sacred, and we're going to deal with everything at the highest possible quality. You know, if you're doing complicated, you know, multi-level transforms, there was a lot of effort put into the code to concatenate all of those so that no matter how many you did, the result was only going to be filtered once. It was going to figure everything out so that those pixels were only filtered once. And that was always, you know, a mandate that we had to maintain that quality.
Yeah.
And so
it stayed that way, right? I mean,
speed was important, but quality was right there.
And so can you talk us through like a single shot? I think the best way to illustrate how you were working. So let's just take one of your missiles. So you've done the model, you've made the shaders, you've got your plate. Did you get tracking data from MatchMove or you just...
No, I think that there were maybe some early tracking programs available, but we match moved everything by hand, and that was a pretty big challenge for some of those missile shots, particularly like where you see the four fly down and race up to the causeway. Like, you know, there was nothing, but you know, they just went shot, you know, helicopter footage over the water. So, you know, I was tracking wave features, you know, I was using grids and nulls and I'm tracking, you know, wave features that are persistent for like a few frames and then moving on to other waves. And it was strictly done by, you know, by eye, by hand. And, you know, and the only way that kind of a looping back around to, you know, Amigas, the only reason that worked as well as it did was because a group of us that were Amiga guys, myself, Philly DiGiorgio, Craig Caton, Jonathan Engstadt, who was a key engineer in Nuke 3, he was working mostly in this weird kind of engineering job where he did hardware engineering, he did software engineering. It was he was just like this mad. He had this mad scientist lab, but he was an Amiga guy, and we came up with these based on some new tech that was kind of taking the lightwave animators by storm is these cards called PARs, or personal animation recorders. And it was a DDR. It was a local DDR that you put in your Amiga that had a, you know, a cheap IDE drive, but you ended up getting beta quality video real time. And like with the drives that were available at the time, something like 4 hours of D1 resolution, you know, 720 by 480 video. And so we put, we were laboring along with like one ACOM digital disc recorder, which had like a minute of storage. And everybody would have to queue up their tests for this thing. And that was just, you know, you might get to see one iteration of something a day. You know, things were very slow back then. And so, you know, we put a proposal together to, you know, for the cost of one more of these expensive digital disc recorders, we could put these Amigas together with PARs and, you know, on video carts, you know, like, and just have them stationed around the DD campus. And then we would send, you know, our tests to that, and we could see and, you know, put it in the artist's hands, take it out of the, having to deal with video IO and queuing up with a bunch of people. And since they were all over the company, you know, you could just find an open one, you know, that nobody was using.
What were you sending to and the Amigas? What were you actually sending them?
Whether wireframe tests, you know, doing basically play blasts, the equivalent of, you know, a modern play blast. But
something like a
you know, the systems back then.
I mean, not there was
There were frames.
Yeah.
They would be compiled on the Amiga. On the board, it had some hardware acceleration for the compression scheme that it was using. I forget if it was like wavelets or it wasn't MPEG. It was higher quality. It was more like motion JPEG or wavelets. But it handled that on the Amiga side. So we sent it SGIs, .SGIs or .RGBs. I actually wrote the script that the on the SGI side that the artists would use to send their frames to the Amiga, and then Jonathan Eggstadt wrote a AREX script that just kind of listened. It was like a little demon that would listen for new incoming images, and then it would take those and rename them into the video file, you know, on the Amiga that then, you know, you would go with your lead or the soup, and you would have these. It was almost like, you know, when we would read about, you know, at Disney Studios, you know, folks gathering around a moviola to watch playback. Well, that became the review process, and we were, you know, an artist could go through and iterate something, you know, where instead of waiting a day to see results back from like, oh, you know, my track still sucks, I got to go, you know, do it again. Because, you know, the machines weren't fast enough to do local real-time, you know, flipbooking or anything like that.
You were looking at a frame, waiting, looking at the next frame. And anyone that's done manual tracking, even now, you know that you make it look good on every single frame, and then you play it, you render it out, you play it back, and there's just that feeling like your stomach sinks and you're like, my God, this looks like nothing. It's terrible. What have I done?
And so, just, you know, imagine... you know, you're doing that now. You go through and you look at it, and like, okay, you see all the things you need to change. Well, over the course of a day or an afternoon, you can whittle that down. You can improve it. You can get it smoother. But, you know, back then we might have to wait till tomorrow or, you know, hours to get, you know, feedback on one iteration. So it really changed the game with being able to iterate and, you know, I could send it, I could go over and look at it, and I didn't have to wait for, you know, my lead to say, you know, oh, you know, on that frame, you got a problem there. You know, artists could go and iterate and see things real time.
And I think...
And it really improved our flow.
And apart from seeing it more often, I think there's something really empowering about, you can see it yourself, right? Because if you only have dailies, you're showing it to your lead and they're going, well, you need to fix that. And it's like, well, I know that. I can see it. I can see the problems. I just haven't been able to see them before. So I would never want to show Swinging Dailies that I hadn't even been able to see myself. That just sounds like the most terrifying and like unpleasant experience I can possibly imagine.
Well, and just imagine like going through, you know, the expense of seeing something like, oh, it's been output to film. You know, we've waited for it to come back from the lab, and then you're screening, you know, film for the first time with your lead, your supervisor, maybe the director, and it's like, oh, it's just all there for everybody to see. And so being able to iterate before it gets to that stage was a game changer for us. And so for that, I must have put up 100 iterations of that Causeway shot just because of the, you know, the match moving was so tough, and you know, I was just doing it the way that I had figured it out and talked to other artists, like, when you've had to do this, how, you know, what techniques do you use, and so just trudging forward.
I mean, that sounds like a lot, but I think of a modern shot with the amount of versions they were doing, match move and then lighting and then effects and then effects, then lighting, then comp, and then add all those versions together, 100 iterations doesn't actually sound that much to get to final, really. It's like you're doing the whole, you know, the whole lot.
Yeah. Although there was a period there where I thought I was never going to get anything that looked smooth over that water. But it eventually worked out. And for that sequence, Nuke was definitely became the tool of choice. As soon as we started using it, it was already much faster than Wavefront Video Composer, because that was partially because, since it was buffer based, kind of like with After Effects, you had to wait for the entire composite before you could make a change or see. Or decide, like, oh, I need to make this fix. You know, it was just the fact that Nuke, you know, it started, you could see it scanline based going down the frame, and it was always kind of reading your input, so you could, oh, I'm going to change this, I'm going to tweak that, and then it would just start over, and you'd see it start to resolve the frame, like, oh, okay, I'm going to adjust that. And that didn't exist really with any of the other tools. So, you know, that was also a big factor in how we adopted, you know, before the interface was there. That was still a level of feedback that we could get to make tweaks, where we were having to come up with like all kinds of weird schemes. I think we had, you know, like various noise generators to, because we knew we had to put, you know, grain back on top. But we were, you know, it was before you could just go get, you know, easily. There's like so many different sources for like, oh, get 4K grain from this stock or that stock to, you know, match things in. We were just doing, we had programs that would just generate noise patterns, kind of like, you know, what you have with plugins nowadays. But we'd have to generate these as image, you know, separate image sequences that we would then, you know, blend in either additively or, you know, folks had their various, you know, it was like folklore at the time in a lot of cases, you know, what's the best way to do this? And you had folks that came from an optical background and folks that came that never went through the whole optical phase, and, you know, they had their methods, and I was fascinated at DD because so many of the, because Price Pethel, who ran the compositing department, and who guided the development of what Nuke needed to be, so many of his compositors and his background was from an optical standpoint, and so I was fascinated by the idea of using analog optical techniques in a digital space. Like, that just as a concept, it seemed so awesome to me. So I was lucky to have him kind of guiding me in some of the harder, you know, what would be, you know, easier now, but, you know, like compositing a these plate elements of you know, that were smoke, you know, how to make them look like mist for a shot where the Harriers wash, it goes over water and, you know, has to blow this big cloud up, you know, getting to work with Price to talk about how the, you know, the water molecules getting hit by light, you know, all of these various things, you know, and coming up with ways to kind of simulate that with this early version of Nuke, and how to treat that layer and how to mix it, you know, with the plate was a awesome experience.
That, I think, is the most rewarding bit in compositing, is when you start to learn, I mean, about anything in VFX, when you just really get to learn about reality from your job. You know, and you're looking at things so much deeper. One of the head of effects at one of us, who was on a previous episode, Arbiter, she talked about how, you know, she would be making coffee and see Voronoi patterns and start to perceive things in this very different way. And I think that eye, and having access to these optical people, and obviously you had the creature workshop in the same building, all of these kind of these techniques, when they're brought through into the new technology of the time, and you know, even now, I think that's when you get some of the most amazing work.
Well, and it just teaches you to think about things in a different way. I mean, that's your example, you know, with the artist seeing, you know, Voronoi patterns different places. The Jim Hillen, you know, he was constantly getting me to look at the world a different way because of the things that we were going to have to come up with a way to represent. You know, we would just be at lunch and he'd be looking at the, you know, the sweat, the bubbles of sweat on the outside of a glass of iced tea or something like that. And so, yeah, those artists that bridged the gap from, you know, there's kind of like before digital took over and after, and the artists that bridged that gap, a lot of them were who I got to learn from. So even at one point, you know, some little Mazda commercial or something like that, struggling with how to light these bowling pins, these giant bowling pins that are supposed to be surrounding this car, and you know, the lighting on them doesn't look like the car, and I'm trying to figure out why. And I'm working with Jay Riddle, who was the supervisor on that. And he starts to tell me about how, you know, what specular and Phong, you know, what those procedures, you know, what they're doing, what they're simulating, and why they exist at the time, and how, you know, the setup that I had was based on using these very common, you know, shading terms for how to do specular reflections. And he was like, but if you look at the plate, you know, they're using this big softbox, which has this, you know, this large surface area, and it's causing the highlight to be more, you know, square and broad. And so he taught me to model lights and to essentially ditch the using any of those kind of hacky reflection terms, and actually just do reflection passes and really mix in the shader the way a really rough early approximation of what, you know, happens in the physically based shaders, you know, in the physically based renderers that we have now, where it's like, you know, you talk to a modern artist, well, of course, you know, this is the way, just the way things work. This is the way light works. But, you know, back then we had these collections of sticks and stones and, you know, trying to make them look like something else, you know, was a challenge. And so those kind of analog, you know, figuring out a way to make these analog effects approximated with the early digital tools was it just really affected perception of how to even go about new problems, how to break them down into, you know, not look at it like a this monolithic giant problem to solve, but all of these smaller problems to solve. And then when you fix all those small problems, then, you know, the big picture is pretty close to being what you want. So at least that's how they taught me, you know, to think about things and how I carry it forward.
Brilliant. So let's move along. So you're at DD, you did True Lies, and then can you tell us about some of the other shows you did? And then I want to also talk about what happened at the end of your time at DD, because I think that's going to be an interesting story as well.
Early days, went from True Lies, things were happening pretty fast after that. Went directly from True Lies, I think, into prep work for Strange Days. That was a smaller project that was going on at the same time as Apollo 13. And we ended up actually kind of putting Strange Days on hold for a little while so that everybody could be all hands on Apollo 13. And then that only lasted, you know, maybe a month, just getting a jump on the schedule.
Which shots were you on Apollo 13?
I got to work on, they were having trouble getting the look of the Mylar after there's an explosion on one of the craft. There's a kind of a cloud of Mylar that is, I guess, had the same velocity and was just kind of traveling around with the ship. And I got the look of that dialed in. And I want to say I worked on the shot where one of the characters, they eject, how do astronauts pee? You know, these things do happen. And I went to, that was one of the funny parts of a tour. I actually went to space camp in Huntsville, Alabama for a week when I was a kid, where they taught us all about astronauts and, you know, how do astronauts pee? That was a funny part of the week. And so, we got to explore that in Apollo 13 and how that's ejected out into space. And I'm pretty sure I helped out on that shot, which I felt was just kind of a full circle sort of thing. Then at the end of that month, I ended up taking over as CG supervisor on Strange Days, and it was a small project, but one of the big things that came out of it was Doug Roble, who was led the software department at DD for a number of years, and just brilliant guy, wrote the tracker, the 3D tracking and 2D tracking software at DD. Strange Days was like the big, like, this is what's going to build the tracking software, because we had a series of shots in that were photographed in downtown LA at night, where we had to do this huge party, and they actually, you know, threw a party, got, I don't know, however many hundreds or thousands of extras, but it still only filled up, you know, maybe a part of a city block. And so we had to make it like the entirety of downtown was just filled with this party.
For the party, so for the year 2000, right? This is, for those who haven't seen Strange Days, it's the...
Right, with all the, you know, everybody's expecting, you know, the bad things to happen, all the computers in the world to stop working, you know, end of the world, that kind of thing. There's all of those types of tensions and pressures, and so this was one of the movies that really capitalized on that. And so it was one of those things that I would really like to know how many iterations Doug himself tracked, you know, those shots. And
it's the worst for tracking anyway, even with the best, even with 3DE or something like that. I mean, it's everyone's worst nightmare to track that kind of plate at night, big crowds of people,
yeah,
flashing lights, parties, smoke, atmospherics. I mean, it's like everything you don't want. Everything you say, what do you want in a tracking shot? It's just not. It's just there.
Yeah. For the sections leading up to it, I think the anti-aircraft lights, like on the tops of the buildings, helped out a lot. But we ended up, they had a surveying company that went and, you know, did surveying a bunch of the downtown buildings. And, you know, that served as a lot of the reference material. But it was still, I mean, Doug is in there. He's tracking, like little fixture lights and stuff that were part of the landscaping, you know, in front of some of these buildings, and just whatever was visible, and lots of iterations. And I'm pretty sure those, like the plates for that, were VistaVision. So they were already, you know, by today's standards, they're just, you know, folks are shooting stuff with their iPhones that is, you know, the higher resolution than what we would get with some of the VistaVision plates back then. I think those were, you know, typically we're doing 2048 by 1556, but these would be 3K by something.
Yeah. And you get TV dramas, you know, that think they need 4-6K, or, you know.
Yeah, and they'll be 8K before long. 8K and 48 frames a second. But yeah, like he was just daily, you know, coming over the new code, running out new tracks, and, you know, we just would whittle away at sections, and we'd get, you know, chunks of frames. You know, this is we think this is good. So then we'd have to do other chunks that were really good, and then sometimes, you know, he would have to figure out ways to sort of blend these almost disparate tracks into one, you know, coherent track, and we eventually got it. But it was one of those things that, you know, it was very long, and it was, you know, going out to film, and things might look okay when we're doing video tests, and then, you know, you go out to film, and oh, you still see the wobble. So then we're doing, you know, crops, video res crops at 1:1 to see, you know, jitter and that sort of thing. It was so tedious, but it was still exhilarating, you know, because it was an adventure. And you would start, you know, just to put things into perspective, you know, the going out to film took so long, you know, you would start the film out process while the comp was still on the farm. And then you would just hope that the farm process wouldn't catch up to the film out process wouldn't catch up to the rendering that was going on the farm. And so you're just kind of playing chicken with,
oh my God,
doom.
Sounds terrifying.
Because it's got to get done to go, you know, to get to the lab before cutoff, so that we got film the next
day. And film is expensive,
day.
And labs are expensive. I mean, it's like, it's not just rendering. You know, you're spending money every time you hit that button. Again.
Oh yeah.
It just sounds terrifying. The whole thing.
Yeah, that feeling you talked about in your gut, like that the first time, you know, they put me in the supervisor position. They asked me to call lights, and I'm like, what? You know, where you had to basically tell them the RGB points, you know, like if you were going to bias something. So I had to learn, like, really quick, like, oh, what do they want me to tell them? Like, okay, let's go house lights and then two stops down. And that just became the standard, because so much of the photography was, because they were so paranoid, like with the producers, it just became standard. Like with film, everything was overexposed by two stops because there was so much latitude. So, looking at the print that was two stops down was generally close to how it was going to look, you know, after it had been, gone through final color. Like final color would be different, but, at least, you know, the density and the contrast and everything would be pretty close.
Because they weren't doing DI, they were doing a grade in the lab.
Yeah, that was later. We actually, I'd left DD, gone to work at Centropolis Effects on Godzilla, and then come back to DD to work on X-Men and O'Brother. And O'Brother was, O'Brother, Where Art Thou? That was the first film that was ever had an end-to-end DI.
And it looks great. I mean, it holds up so well. It's so stylized. I mean, it's not over-stylized like some of the later, when they got a bit carried away and everything was like really green or really blue, you know, like they'd kind of, they were still being respectful for the actual tonalities a little bit. And I think now we're coming back to that. So I think that was just a beautiful grade on that show.
And they gave, you know, I think a big reason why that is because they gave total control over that to Roger Deakins. Because he was, you know, he shot it, and then he was, they didn't have a studio side visual effects supervisor. You know, we dealt with Roger Deakins, you know, and he would come and look at the comps, and he was very specific on, you know, what we did everything pre-DI, so he was already thinking about the way it was going to look through the DI process while he was tuning, you know, all of the compositing levels, particularly the brightness in the skies.
That's a dream. I think
did the
ideal world, the DOP would be involved in every final comp review. I think every show would look better.
Yeah, I mean, it's the kind of thing that it makes absolute sense, and it's so rare. You know, I know that they got, you know, their own schedules. Maybe they're on to the next job, but it was a dream. You know, there was no ambiguity with him. He had such a clear, you know, vision of what he wanted to see, and so it was a great experience.
That's brilliant. So, what was the actual work on that? What kind of things were you doing on O'Brother about that? Because it's again, we're in the realm of kind of invisible. I mean, you've got the flood, the big flood sequence.
Yeah, there was a series of shots where, you know, with the actors, they were shot in a tank on a lot that I think, you know, is about the size of a above-ground swimming pool. You know, it wasn't very big. So we had to continue, extend the water to the horizon and then add the tops of buildings and the tops of trees in the water. And that was a team of myself and Garmin Herigstad and Ryo Sakaguchi, I'm pretty sure, did most of those shots. Was all Johnny Gibson wrote us a really trick RenderMan shader that this was the days when RenderMan was still completely based on the Rays algorithm, renders everything you ever saw, which was just micropolygon, more scan line. I mean, it wasn't scan line, but you know, it wasn't a ray tracer. It didn't have any inherent ray trace or radiosity or any kind of physically based shading, and so you had to just come up with schemes for reflection mapping but it was so, you know, user extensible that Johnny was actually able to write a ray tracer inside a surface shader. You know, it only worked with the information that you passed to that surface shader, but we were able to define these kind of cards and this concept of cards that were just coordinates and a texture. And the shader essentially applied them to a polygon that it created and gave true reflections in the water of these images of trees and houses for the reflections of them, you know, sticking out above the water.
It's just mind blowing stuff.
it seems like the craziest, dumbest way to do things in a modern sense, but back then, you know, that was.
I mean, I guess they're going through that again, amazing. In real time. In the real-time world, they're having to think of these. I mean, there is real-time ray tracing, but they're still having to think of these kind of tricks. Again, you know, had to make a comeback just to get the speed to 25, 50 frames a second.
We're doing that and felt, you know, we patted ourselves on the back pretty good for that one. You know, figuring out how to do that. Or Johnny figuring out how to do that. He was a great wizard to have access to.
That's
yeah. And so we did those shots, and then the animation department at DD, there was a couple of shots with there was a gag in there where one of the gangsters has a real problem with cows, and they hit he starts shooting cows, and we did I'm pretty sure we did some digital squibs on some real cows, and then they did a digital cow that a real car, they had a gag in the road that just made it look like it bumped something heavy, and
so not a stuffy, they didn't have like a stuffy of a cow, they just had a
no ball out of it. It was all oddly enough, it was done with like a part of a ramp on one side that was partially buried in the ground, so that it just gave this shimmy, this strong shimmy as it, it passed by this section of road. And so we had to remove the that mechanism from the road, and then they did a digital cow, and we actually had to do a presentation for PETA, because when they screened the film for PETA, PETA was like, how did you hit a car? I mean, how did you hit a cow with a car and not hurt it? We're not going to give you the seal unless we see proof that you didn't just, maim this cow. And so we had to do this whole, dog and pony show, and they got the grins from animation and the effects, and the producers were so just ear to ear, because they were like, yeah, they had to show them the plate and the wireframes and the buildup and removing everything to prove that it was, it wasn't a real cow.
That's the most,
so that they would give the seal.
That's the highest accolade, really, I think.
Yeah.
Prove that it's fake. You have to prove that it's fake.
I mean, yeah, we're in the middle of, deadline, and we're just trying to make everything work. But I don't think anybody minded having to put in some extra time to come up with this little dog and pony.
So so I noticed this, obviously, this big thing with your reels on your Vimeo, and it goes from your Hollywood reel, and then you've got this indie reel, and you've got Crowdfunder. So at some point, do you want to tell us a bit what happened there?
Yeah, in the late 90s, after my next youngest brother, Tim, had moved out to L.A., and he started working in the industry on the production end, started as a PA and then coordinator, and was working up to producer. He had originally wanted to go to film school, and we just over the years, and everybody, going back to CalArts, we all had our ideas for like some film that we wanted to make, whether it was a short film or, a feature idea. And that was always, everybody's kind of in the back of everybody's head was, I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to come up with, my film. And there's not a whole lot of precedent for visual effects people, breaking out and doing, a really good film. But it, it was the dream of all of us. And so Tim and I, we would get together, and we did a little short film that we had a lot of fun just kind of learning digital editing, learning to use, what the limits were of the, DV technology that was still like really new and coming out. And it just gave us a little bit more confidence. Like, we could probably make a movie. And we started talking to, our stepbrother, John, who was, he's just one of these natural born salesmen kind of folks. He started getting interested like in raising the money for it and being a producer on it and all that. So we ended up, my brother Tim left his job in LA, moved back to Texas, and he and John are going around, and they're just trying to raise money to make a film. And we had a couple of different ideas. Tim and I really like horror movies. We wanted to make a horror movie because we figured, like, you know, that had the best shot of getting its money back, and it would be fun. And, you know, within the horror community, there's people that will see absolutely anything. So even if it's not good, there's going to be people that are going to see it. Cause that's just the way it works. And so, I think for a couple of the ideas, a common character was having, you know, somebody that's the richest guy in town or whatever. We just needed a big house. And one of his friends was an architect who worked on this guy's mansion here, you know, a big money guy in Austin. And so she ends up brokering an introduction, and they go to see this guy's house, and it's just huge. It's crazy movie level mansion, and he just starts talking about, you know, what are y'all planning on doing? And we lay out the typical sort of, you know, having read the Raimi book and I think the book that the guy, I forget his name now, who did the Hardware Wars and those, you know, kooky short films from like the late 70s and early 80s, you know, how they would go about raising money to make their films from, you know, doctors and lawyers that are friends of the family, or, you know, that kind of thing, and build up a budget over, you know, all of these different people. And Rusty's like, yeah, you don't want to do that. You don't want to go to a bunch of guys to get a little bit of money. You want to go to like one or a couple of guys and get all the money. And, and so John's like, well, yeah, I mean, that sounds great and all. We don't know those kind of people. Do you know those kind of people? And so Rusty's like, well, yeah. And so he ends up having a couple of guys that are into car dealerships and real estate here. And he, you know, talked to them, and they were like, yeah, you know, this could be fun. Let's make a movie. It just can't be a horror movie, and it can't have nudity. Because one of them was, you know, very religious. And we're like, wow, you know, this guy doesn't want his money back. But, okay, we'll figure out a way. We'll figure out within this framework, you know, what we can make. And so one of the ideas that we had that I don't even know if I should say, because it's it got shut down because Columbine happened.
Oh.
And it was it had to do, it was very, it was not serious. But it dealt with, you know, a lot of a cartoon gun and explosion violence at a school. And we were thinking more, you know, along the lines of, you know, because what you would see in anime and Spy versus Spy. And then this real life thing happened, and we're like, okay, yeah, nobody's going to let us make this movie, because it's just too, now it would be insensitive. Yeah. And we just, yeah, we're not going to go there. So we ended up taking some of those elements, and we thought like, okay, well, a really good kind of pattern to get sort of what we were wanting initially, but that'll fit within everybody's framework, is this to make the idea loosely based on this anime called Project Echo that has these girls running around in a high school. You know, one of them can make robots, and so there's kung fu fighting, there's robots, little robots, big robots. We still got our explosions and everything, but it's like really over the top, like a bazooka and, you know, cartoony bazooka and little, you know, anime wrist rockets and that sort of thing. And thankfully nobody had a problem with that, you know, cause it was just so far out there and nothing like, you know, like the reality. And so we made this indie picture called Extracurricular in 2001. Shot it at this high school out here over the course of about a month, where it was the most amazing experience, because since, you know, unlike, you know, if you're in LA or you're in a big city that gets used for, you know, films and that sort of thing a lot. You know, people are just annoyed by the process, that, you know, the trucks and everybody messing up parking or messing up their commute or, you know, whatever. But, you know, you get out to a small town out here, and if you're respectful and you're gracious with people, you know, like, they just wanted to help us. And so, like, we got access to a school for free, basically. We just had to pay for, you know, cleaning, and when we were done, and we got access to a football field. We just had to pay to have it restriped, you know, at the end, but we ended up shooting, like, this full, you know, football game and all of these sequences in, you know, this real school and real classrooms for, you know, practically nothing.
That's brilliant.
And folks just gave us, you know, the principal of the school, like, he gave us his keys to the school.
And you're local. This is your hometown, right? So you're, like...
Kind of our summer town. We grew up mostly in Corpus Christi, Texas, on the coast, but Austin, Texas, is where we would come to visit our mom, you know, during the summer times, and it became like our second home. And Pflugerville is like a little suburb right on the outskirts of Austin, and so yeah, we were able to do it here, just thanks to all the hospitality of people who thought it was neat to be, you know, part of a movie. And we just always made sure that, you know, we were respectful of property, respectful of everybody's time and everything. And as long as we did that, you know, people were, it was kind of amazing how they would, you know, give us access to something for free, or give us, you know, food for free, or, you know, whatever. It was you know, we're never going to make any money back from this movie, but it was still an awesome experience to make.
And did it get distributed?
It did. We ended up, after, and I think we had, you know, funding problems, where we ended up having to do a second round of getting finances for finishing, we ended up shooting it all HD. It was one of the first narrative films shot on the HDW F900 when Sony first came out with the 24p HD cameras. I think Rodriguez, about the same time, was shooting Once Upon a Time in Mexico. And then... like, there were so few of these cameras at our wrap party. Our rental agent out of Dallas, like, he came to pick up the camera to put it on a plane to send it to California to Cameron, because it was one of the cameras that was used on the stereo HD rig that went down to the Titanic. Like straight from our party on a plane to Cameron to go underwater. There were just not that many. But we had to build a, you know, very, at the time, you know, very expensive HD editorial system to just, you know, back then a terabyte of storage was $16,000 in raw drives.
Wow. I mean,
yeah. Yeah, it was.
And you'd always think, when will I ever use a terabyte? I remember, like, when they were like, oh, you can get a gigabyte. You're like, well, how am I going to fill a gigabyte? And then you're like, 100 gigabytes. I never fill 100 gigabytes. And every time, it's like traffic, right? So you build the biggest road and it's always full.
Yeah, whatever you do will just expand to meet the bounds of, you know, whatever container you provide it. but yeah, so we had to. You know, we had to come up with a plan for how we were going to do that. And thankfully, this company, Pinnacle at the time, that, you know, would eventually get absorbed, I think, by Avid, they had this board, the Cinewave, and it was only a couple grand. And so, you know, we were able to to build this Macintosh-based editorial system for like I think all in for the machine and everything, it was under $10,000, but it used, you know, like $16,000 worth of storage, and then it was probably another, you know, just $2,000 or $3,000 for the enclosures and the cables. Like the cables were insane, like hundreds of it's like ultra SCSI 160, I think. These the like you could measure the weight of the cables in pounds. They were so like connecting between all of these enclosures. It was crazy, and it sounded like an aircraft when everything, yeah, you know, was booted up, because it was in full like the drives were in four full size towers that just like it just sounded like a jet engine. It was crazy. We built this thing and finished over 100 shots. You know, pretty much just me and my brother. While we were, you know, we ended up coming back to LA to get day jobs. You know, while we were finishing our film, and I actually ended up working for a period with the company that eventually became our sales agent. Because we got it finished, got it in the Deep Ellum Film Festival in Dallas, and then I took it along with the wife of one of the executive producers, and we went to the American Film Market in Santa Monica, which is like this big, you know, it's like a convention where buyers and sellers meet to, I think it's mostly foreign buyers of American product, and we just, you know, all we knew was the naive way, we'd never done this ourselves, so we just went door to door from the, it all takes place in this hotel in Santa Monica, and we just went pretty much from the top and worked our way down to the basement, you know, because they when they're doing this, they rip all the beds out, they, and every room just becomes an office for, you know, either a seller or a buyer. And so we had this little clamshell DVD player, and we're just walking around saying, "Hey, do you want to see our, are you acquiring new films?" And we'd show them our trailer, or, you know, give them a screener. And at the end of that, we ended up getting callbacks from about a half dozen different sales agents, and ended up going with one that was Creative Light Worldwide, who they, we'd never heard of them before. We'd never heard of most of these companies before, but we liked them because they were kind of, they dealt with some of the vanity projects of William Shatner. Like he had a couple of, you know, direct to video projects that were on there, and Mark Hamill had this. He had done this comic book, the movie, little indie documentary. They had that. Some of these more obscure Bruce Campbell movies, like The Man with the Screaming Brain, was in, you know, they handled the sales for that. So we're like, okay, you know, as low budget indies go, we're in pretty good company. So, you know, we ended up signing up with them, and you know, it started, I think we got into like Israeli TV and then some South American TV, and then eventually, you know, like Thai home videos, one of my favorite versions of the film that came out, and we were always so fascinated to see what they would do with, you know, like the cover art and that sort of thing. And sometimes they would come up with this cover art that we just felt bad because it does not represent our film at all. Like for the Japanese market, somebody did this full on, it looks like you're going to see a kaiju movie. Like they painted it and everything. It's beautiful that just, that they did this, you know, crazy poster for our little movie.
I'm going to make sure that we get the posters. If you can send me some JPEGs of these posters, I'll put them on the YouTube version of this.
Okay, yeah, I'll send them. But we didn't get, we got a North American home video distribution, and I can't even remember the name of the company now. I don't think they're around They were like down the hall from Creative Light. And, you know, we saw it for a while there. You know, we'd take pictures, like if we were at Fry's or if we were at Best Buy and we found a copy of our movie, we'd take, you know, take pictures of where we found it. And yeah, it was fun. It didn't really lead to anything after that. You know, we were back full time working in visual effects. I ended up working at Sony and Rhythm and Hughes, and then just kind of falling back into that. And and by, you know, late 2008, you know, it'd been some years since we had done that, and I was really unhappy in the career, and had become engaged, and that didn't work out, and so it was like personal life wasn't any kind of fun. I'm working on movies that I don't, you know, I don't really enjoy the process anymore, and so I ended up coming back to Texas in 2009, and then just, you know, taking a kind of a long hiatus for a while, and, you know, figuring out what to do, because for so much of my life, you know, it was CG and visual effects, and that was the only thing that made me happy, and so I had to kind of refigure out, you know, like, okay, well, the independent film thing didn't change my life. It was a great experience and everything, and we met a lot of really cool people and had fun. But so, you know, having to figure out, you know, what was gonna come next, and had a family, like, right kind of coincident in that period, which didn't help my mood. Had a family member that was kidnapped.
Oh my God.
And so I was, I also, like, that was a really good, sort of focus for, okay, well, you're not happy with anything that's going on here. What can you do to kind of help out in this situation? And it ended up being, like, very fast, like 48 hours. These folks that thought, you know, that they were going to make off with a bag of money from my uncle, ended up having the two or three, you know, police forces, a couple of county sheriffs, the Texas Rangers, the FBI, all of these people just come down on them within 48 hours, and they were caught, and then my stepdad was returned, mostly unharmed. And but then after that, you know, there's like court and going to the trials and stuff like that. So that was sort of my life for a little while, kind of just helping with that. And then Tim, you know, it was kind of 10 years. We get to 10 years after we made Extracurricular, and he gets the idea to do, you know, another one, but this time we're going to do it like we always wanted. We're going to do a horror movie. We're going to do it much smaller. We ended up, you know, shooting it in a couple weeks, did it kind of the same way that we made Extracurricular, this film called Sick Boy, that we shot here in Austin, and kind of like the first one. You know, if you go, you're talking to people that aren't used to, you know, the way they haven't been inconvenienced, you know, most of their life by film people. So we were able to get, you know, access to this really cool house and a lot of other, you know, cool things, either just super cheap or for free. Because I think, you know, the first film, the budget ended up being under 200 grand all in, I'm pretty sure. This one was like it was under 50 grand. You know, it was a lot of money that Tim had saved, and then just a few, you know, other executive producers that threw in some. And we made this little zombie movie. Only this time, we ended up getting Debbie Roshan, who's a like legit scream queen, has done at that point had done over 200 movies, mostly horror movies, and she was doing a show with Dee Schneider from Twisted Sister on Fangoria. they had a satellite radio show where they talked about horror movies, and she's just like super well known, and we knew she was a friend of this girl Becky, who had been played a small part in Extracurricular as this juvenile delinquent. We had so much fun with her, and she's been a friend ever since then. She ended up getting our script to Debbie Roshan, who said, you know, yeah, I'll do this. And so we made this little, you know, this little film, and one of the ways to save money, one of the biggest expenses that we had on the first one was what we paid our DP. And so I was like, okay, well, you know, I'll shoot this one. And I probably shouldn't have said that, but, you know, I like to jump in and just volunteer. And so I ended up, you know, shooting this one and then doing, you know, almost all of the visual effects afterwards. But, you know, as technology had changed, you know, this was shot all on a Canon 7D. And, you know, we're able to just see everything real time. Anymore. So,
and the cost of your machine was a lot less, right? You didn't need 16 grand to buy.
Yeah, we made. Oh yeah, no. We made this thing on. You know, we had IMAX. You know, at the time, we made this thing on IMAX, and just the idea of that seems kind of silly, but at the time, we were like, yeah, like that's how great things have become. We can make a better film now on IMAX, you know, for super cheap versus, you know, what cost hundreds of thousands of dollars.
I mean, I'm editing this podcast on Resolve. And when I think of like DaVinci Resolve, and it just seems almost like insulting to the time when, you know, it was used on movies and it cost, you know, the price of a house or more.
When we're making Extracurricular, that camera costs like, without lenses was like $100,000. And then the deck, when we had to rent a deck, just to lay the tape off to our arrays, like that deck was $100,000, you know, for the VTR. not anymore. At least not, you know, you don't have to deal with that on the,
this movie,
you just use your iPhone.
You got a horror movie on the circuit. And did you continue making any movies? And I know you've gone back into VFX on your
Genie. We thought we were going to, that this would be the one that would lead to more, and it did lead to more, at least more interest, because since we did take, you know, the step of making sure there was a name that it was recognizable, it was also going to be the comeback or the kind of reintroduction of Skye Bartusiak as a more adult, as an older actress, where she had been a child actor who'd worked with Mel Gibson on The Patriot, and she'd worked on 24. But she was a very young little girl then, and she had left to go concentrate on school and hadn't done acting in a while, and so... also just, you know, kind of through luck and happenstance and mutual contacts, her mom ended up hearing about the project that we were starting to make. I don't know if it was just through, you know, we were putting notices up on the Texas Film Commission or what, but we ended up finding out that, you know, they were looking for a vehicle for Sky, probably horror, to be her kind of, here I am as an adult actor now. And
so a horror movie is great because it's as far from your child movie
right
time as possible.
And unfortunately, that it would end up also being her last movie. She passed away a couple of years after we finished. We had these names associated with it, and within hours of the first official notice on the Fangoria website going up about how, you know, it was completed and we were finishing up editorial, then we just started getting contacted by sales reps and distributors, and we ended up going with Raven Banner, who was a much bigger step up in terms of representation, where they're one of the sales agents that Alamo Drafthouse deals with, you know, for their projects, and they had they appeared to have a really good international presence, and so really liked them, their sensibilities, the library projects that they had, and so they ended up getting us like really good distributors overseas. So like 101 Films in Europe, who handles a lot of Warner Brothers stuff, like they put out a really good release. We got a really good release in Australia, I think. Anchor Bay picked it up in Canada. But we didn't get a really good North American U.S. region distributor. They split up. Normally, I think Canada and the U.S. will typically be handled by one company, but it ended up being Anchor Bay and in Canada, and then this company that I don't even think is still around anymore. They were a startup, you know, with execs from Lionsgate and a bunch of other companies, and I think they just entered the market too cash poor to really make it out, and it just ended up being our luck that they picked it up, and there's no streaming. You know, there ended up being no streaming rights. It was only ever released on DVD, I think. And so we're hoping one of these days to be able to get that redone at some point, so that we can get it on Prime, or at least, you know, get a proper U.S. Blu-ray. Like, you'd have to go out of, go to a different region.
But I can pick it up being in London.
Yeah, yeah. In the UK, I'm pretty sure it's 101 Films has it, and we did interviews with a couple of horror podcasts. One of them, it was in England. We got some really good reviews. We had some, you know, they tell you don't read the reviews, but we at least got a few really nice words said about it. One of the regulars on Ain't It Cool News. He put us on his, you know, 30 Days of Halloween, you know, a new horror movie, or 31 Days. He put us on his list of horror movies that he recommended, you know, going through a horror movie every day. So we thought that was really cool. And we ended up, you know, talking to Raven Banner about, you know, they were like, hey, you know, we want to hear about any new projects that you have going on, and if you're, you know, wanting to bounce ideas off of us, you know, come talk to us. But it wasn't like the, you know, like, oh, so-and-so hires so-and-so for a three-picture, you know, first look deal. You know, that kind of deal never happened. So it was like, okay, well, we really don't want to go through the trouble of, you know, raising all the money ourselves and handling all of this. So from that point on, you know, we just kind of drifted back into our lives of post-production at times.
So you basically went back into doing post-production, but were you working now on more indie projects? Is that?
Yeah. Yeah. We ended up, eventually the way it worked out, ended up being a company called Mighty Coconut that was started by Martel, Lucas Martel, and my brother and Tad Catalano, after kind of finishing this short film called The Ocean Maker. And then we started getting other clients. And they, you know, I came in kind of at first to help out Tim with some, you know, some complicated post stuff. And then he was like, you know, hey, my brother can help out on these projects. And so I got brought in for this. It was for a museum. I think it was all about World War II, doing a presentation for a museum made by this group of historians. And so out of there, we ended up getting a bit of film work and some other kind of regional commercial stuff. And then we got approached, or Tim ended up approaching Google and YouTube. They were just starting to think about making their own content. They were going to start a premium service. Back then, it was called YouTube Red,
yeah.
Which I think now it's whatever it is.
Google Premium, Google Plus, no, Google something.
Yeah.
Something Google.
But it was one of those launches where I think they had the problem where they didn't really research when they did the YouTube Red. There's a porn website that's a little too close to that naming. And so I think too many people found that instead of their premium service. So that's probably at least partially why the name got changed. But they some of the first premium content that they were gonna do was, I don't know if we knew at the time about Cobra Kai, they had two animated shows. One of them was Fruit Ninja, and the other one was this project called The Kings of Atlantis, which was based on this YouTube machinima show that these two guys made in Minecraft, where they created this whole other kind of world within Minecraft. And they had these characters, a penguin and a rooster, that were underwater dealing with all these fish people. And it had built up such a strong kind of fan community that they gave them
I think if you're show. Not like under 10 years old, or you're not a parent with kids of that age, you don't even know about this entire subculture. But Minecraft videos are huge, and I think I've seen this one. They are enormous, and there's a public, it's a bit like the Holo community. There's a you know, kids will watch hours and hours and hours until you drag them away of this stuff.
So they gave them their shot. They gave them an animated series, and we ended up co-producing it and did all the animation, hired the animators. They had a writing room that they put together, and then Tim and some folks at Mighty Coconut would occasionally like rewrite or punch up, or you know, make some of the gags funnier. And so we made this show for YouTube, and it was a lot of fun. And we were all ready to go, you know, on whatever the next one was, because we, you know, we hit every deadline. They always told us, you know, how, you know, we were so good to deal with. You know, they didn't have any worries with this. And so, you know, after we were done with this, they had I think it was a sci-fi take on Robin Hood or King Arthur, or something like that. You know, it was a sci-fi reimagining of a classic, you know, character. And, you know, rather than give it to, you know, who had come through, you know, their first project, you know, gave them no hassles, they ended up going with, you know, somebody else that, where they were, you know, they didn't get very much of a kind of like a state help, you know, the Texas Film Commission. I don't know that they, like, I think we got some benefits, you know, from the production being based in Texas, but but they ended up going with somebody that where they got, you know, better deals or better tax breaks or something like that. Yeah. And then they ended up having nothing but problems with that vendor and they regretted it. And we were like, yeah, you know, we were here. We could have done it for you. But we ended up, working on this, you know, like a Turkish action film called The Mountain. And we ended up, we were contacted by this Russian filmmaker, Ilya Nashur. I'm probably not saying his name right, but he's in this band. He's also in this band called Biting Elbows. And they had done, you know, a couple of crazy music videos that were all done by, you know, strapping a GoPro onto a stuntman and then running, you know, running around so it's a first person, you know, it's like you're watching a live action first person shooter, you know, with this guy running away from all these gangsters and with this device that lets him teleport, you know, if it gets wet, something silly like that. But he came up with this movie called Hardcore Henry, and we ended up doing pretty much the final reel of that. Just this crazy unbroken, and that's, you know, pretty much the way most of the film is. It's cut, but it's all cut in a way that it feels continuous in real time. When we saw the rough, you know, reel, what we were going to have to be dealing with, it looked, you know, like it was going to be crazy, because it's all, you know, GoPro is going to be a lot of
jelly cam
hard work. But I told Tim, I was like, we got to do this movie. This is going to be so cool. And I almost regretted those words, but it did end up being, you know, a lot of fun. And
is your company still going? Are you still doing productions today? Or
no, Mighty Coconut ended up, you know, we were, you know, as the profile of the projects got better and better, you know, we were always looking for, because Lucas had all these great ideas for animated films, and we had we'd acquired the rights to some existing publications, children's books and that sort of thing, and got, you know, the authors, some pretty high profile authors, you know, involved in you know, that were going to be executive producers, and we were pitching these things, but nobody was really biting. Nobody wanted to spend that kind of money on these projects, unfortunately. And so none of those kind of production-oriented, non-vendor projects ever really took off. Lucas is also, in addition to being a writer and a animator, he's also a coder, and he was coming up with video game ideas. And so Mighty Coconut still exists today. I and my brother don't work there anymore, but he was able to just keep the company going based on what he was doing in the AR, VR, and game space. And they've got probably the most popular VR game right now. It's Walkabout Mini Golf. And, you know, they're doing expansion packs, and it's, you know, it's doing gangbusters on like the Oculus and those platforms. And so it's great that, that Mighty Coconut lives on. You know, I wish we were also, you know, making these, animated series and animated films as well, but, you know, things don't always
work
out. Never
say never. It sounds like you've had a real roller coaster ride across everything, over, you know, sort of 20, almost 30 years of career. I'm about 22, from the, you know, late 90s into year 2022. And so now, what are you doing now?
Now I work for another company here in Austin, Rooster Teeth, which it got its start doing Halo Machinima. You know, they're the company behind Red versus Blue. That I guess they caught Microsoft in a really generous time, because you know they're using all of they're using Halo IP, they're using, you know, their imagery and everything, but they were able to build a business around making these funny machinimas set in the Halo world, and Microsoft played ball with them and let them do merchandising and all of that. And one of the original animators working on Red versus Blue, this fellow Monty Ohm, he came up with an idea for an anime-inspired show called Ruby. And they ended up making that, and he passed away tragically after the third season, I believe, which is about when a cousin of mine made me aware of the show, and we watched it when, like, before everything that had been done up to that point before, like, a Christmas party or something like that. And I thought it was great because I loved anime, and here was, wow, like, this is the closest thing that I've seen to, you know, if you didn't tell me that this was made outside of Japan, I would have assumed it was made in Japan, but it was made right here in Austin. And so, you know, after things started winding down at Mighty Coconut for vendor work, and they couldn't support, you know, having artists on the expenses anymore, I ended up picking up a contract job at Rooster Teeth working on Ruby, and that was on the sixth season of Ruby, and I came back for the seventh as a lead for their new, they were rolling in crowd animation into the visual post and VFX side of making the show, and completely, you know, reworking how crowd animation was done in Houdini. And so I came back to lead that effort. And so now we're working on both the ninth season and currently the first of two features set in the Ruby universe. And so I'm pretty stoked to be, you know, working in animation once again for a show that I really like watching. So,
and that's the extra bonus. I think it's really interesting about your voyage is you've gone through the burnout, you've come out, you've taken a step back, you've done your own projects, and you've kind of come back, I guess, sort of re-energized in a way. Like you've kind of found your mojo again by just going, right, you know what, I'm just going to do my own thing. I'm just going to do whatever I thought of doing before. I'm not going to try and, you know, work in these other jobs. And I think that's a really important lesson for anyone that is, you know, in that period now, of, you know, stuck in a rut, or, you know, it's just too much. It's like, you know, and then there are so many options you can do with your skills and your eye and your abilities.
You know, some things that sometime I couldn't, you know, I wish somebody had told me is, you know, if you get into those ruts and you get into those times when you're not, you know, not really sure, you know, that you even like doing this anymore, like things change, you know, and things have changed so much. I mean, right about the time that I, you know, had that moment for myself when things didn't make sense to me anymore, and I moved, then that's when the whole, you know, post just started shutting down everywhere, and companies were going out of business, and, you know, Rhythm and Hues, there was the big, you know, the worldwide, you know, going green, the life after Pi sort of phenomenon. Yeah. You know, I saw that, and went through that period just as an observer, because I was, you know, not doing anything in that space, and it was like there was a part of me that was like, "Wow, I couldn't have timed my exit better,"
right?
because it was horrifying to see this happen on the outside. But things changed and they improved and companies came back, and the work that's being done now is just astounding. And then to think, you know, we were worried once again, you know, when COVID happened, and it was like, what, you know, there was so much, just not knowing, you know, what's going to happen, but companies adapted and we really quickly, you know, figured out what do we got to do to keep the ball rolling, to keep production rolling, to keep everybody working and busy and, you know, getting paid, but also to know, have some security and to know, you know, what's going to happen tomorrow. And, you know, the whole work from home phenomenon happened. And that's, I mean, that is, been such a game changer with, you know, people. I know people that are working here, you know, that used to work at Rooster Teeth, but they're working, you know, for Weta now, or they're working for a company in Canada, or they're working in LA. Like, this kind of global access to artists, and then artists' access to companies and work has been pretty incredible.
Because you had to go to LA to get your job at the beginning. Yeah. You had to move, and that meant, you know, it's not near either. I always underestimate it in Europe, because, you know, you travel that kind of distance, you're in another country, and maybe you travel across two countries, but you know, it's, you know, it's a big deal, right? And I've seen that from work from home, so many artists who moved out of London, because, you know, in places, I guess, like LA, high rent, high real estate prices, high cost of living, and
you, I got to live there for a couple of months when I was working on Fifth Element, and that's like 1995, 96, somewhere in there, and I couldn't believe the prices then. Like, I wouldn't want to see rent now. and I was just happy that I wasn't having to pay for any of it. You know, I had Gaumont and DD paying for everything. But I would have loved to live in London, but I couldn't imagine paying for it.
Well, and coming from someone who's lived in LA, that actually shocks me. That's quite terrifying. But we're going to wrap up, I guess, because I've kept you for 2.5 hours. Oh, nearly 3 hours, 2 hours from our original hour slot. So actually 3 hours. Wow, I think this is a record. But just to round up, what would be, I guess, your advice for someone starting out today?
Don't be intimidated by the challenge. I mean, especially compared to when I was first coming up, don't be afraid of the challenge. Don't think that you have to spend a lot of money to learn how to do this. There are so many resources on, you know, whether it's podcasts or YouTube, or, and then there's so much free. There's also really great, you know, for not that much money, courses online and things that you can take. But, you know, really go after everything that you can that's just there and available. You know, look for the answers to your problems, and just keep moving forward. Don't wait for somebody else to solve your issues. You know, if you keep pushing your work forward and you keep learning new things, you know, that's just going to make you a better artist, going to make you better valued by, you know, those around you. And it's just going to lead to better, you know, you being given better opportunities, or opportunities presenting themselves that you're able to, you know, realize sooner rather than later, you know, the longer that you progress. So, I mean, I guess that would be the best I could say.
Fantastic. So thank you very much for your time. And I'm really looking forward to seeing the reaction to this, because I think I know there are so many artists out there who are just fascinated by these early days, and who've, you know, obviously come in a lot later. So I think you've really thrown some light on that. And I think there are a lot of indie filmmakers who are also interested in that journey. So I'm really excited about this. So I think it's going to be really cool.